Most gracious sovereign, we, your Majesty's most dutiful and loyal subjects, the Commons of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, in Parliament assembled, beg leave to offer our humble thanks to your Majesty for the gracious speech which your Majesty has addressed to both Houses of Parliament. It might be a Queen's speech, Mr. Speaker, but I am only the second woman to propose the loyal address in Her Majesty's long reign. 57 years ago, the then Lady Tweedsmuir, member for Aberdeen South, had the double pressure of proposing the loyal address and making her maiden speech. What she says deserves our consideration for its relevance today. She started by extolling the strengths of Scotland in the United Kingdom. Challenges facing the country, forging a new relationship with Europe based on trade and cooperation, the creation of a new defence able to respond to Russian aggression, and of growing the economy, fusing the gigantic resources of the old world to the new. She then discusses the cost of living, reform of the upper house, and finished by advocating the advantages of having more women parliamentarians. It is a shame that the response she received from the then Leader of the Opposition was less able to stand up to contemporary scrutiny. Mr. Gaitskill, with gallant intent, I am sure, replied to a nodding Commons that Lady Tweedsmuir had probably made some good points, but that he, alas, was unable to respond to any of them. For such was the distraction of her soft, attractive voice. He that despite being a grandmother, she was rather easy on the arm. He found it quite impossible to concentrate on anything she had had to say. In recounting this, Mr. Speaker, I realise I may have left the current Leader of the Opposition with a very modern man's dilemma, as he says. Does he now risk insulting me if he thinks it's on the issues raised and failed to mention that I am also a softly spoken charmer? Or if he were to compliment me, does he risk the wrath of the Labour Party's Women's Caucus? Potentially using the newly introduced power of recall? These are perilous times for a chap. Whatever he decides to do, Mr. Speaker, I hope that this will mark the end of the parliamentary leap year. Women parliamentarians should be allowed to propose more than once every 57 years. Tweedsmuir's first husband, Major Sir Arthur Lindsay Grant of the Grenadier Guards, was killed 70 years ago in Normandy, aged 32, in the aftermath of D-Day. It was from Portsmouth that he and other heroes of that blood-red dawn of June the 6th, 1944, set sail. And it will be Portsmouth that will provide the focal point for our national commemoration of that blow for freedom, which does indeed live in history. Yeah. At 70 years' distance, the invasion of Normandy is almost impossible to comprehend in its scale and industry. I have been able to understand it through speaking to the people who were there, many of whom it is my privilege to represent. This most remarkable wartime episode was only made possible through the blood, sweat and tears of so-called ordinary people. The anniversary is a chance to reflect on what the people of this country can achieve when we are united in a common cause. I am proud that this Parliament has recognised the unique service of our armed forces and enshrined a covenant in law. Proud that we have seen the injustices of the past addressed by the striking of the Arctic Star and the Bomber Command class. Proud that we have introduced the mesothelioma bill, by which those dockyard workers in my city who would otherwise be left without assistance will receive support, and that we are now to create an armed forces ombudsman to further protect the interests of service personnel. I am pleased too that this Defence Secretary has abandoned the unfortunate tradition of outlining the number of ships required in a defence review and then ordering precisely half of them. Since the SDSR, extra warships have been commissioned, three extra ships. A former member for Portsmouth and Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Hedwith Muse, would have approved. In 1917, he seconded the Loyal Address in his number 1B uniform, and in the course of his remarks, advised that the naval service was better praised by an outsider than one that belongs to it. I, in contrast, am not in my uniform. Alas, chamber protocol and concerns for the Honourable Member for Beckenham's blood pressure prevent me. Praise the senior service from within. Since King Alfred, whose name my reservist unit bears, first fitted out the fleet at Portsmouth, she has been the crucible for our maritime nation's considerable accomplishments. The battles of the Solent, Solar Bay, Trafalgar and the Falklands, to name but a few. In 1902, she was home to the Navy's first submarines, a capability dismissed by some admirals at the time as underhand, unfair, and damned un-English. And 4 years later, she hailed the awesome step change in firepower brought by the Dreadnought. Today, the Type 45s, the most sophisticated and capable warships in the world, call Portsmouth home, and so too will the Queen Elizabeth-class carriers, the first of which will be named exactly 1 month from today, after our sovereign. Yeah. Their arrival in Portsmouth will see more tonnage in the harbour than at any time since Lady Tweedsmuir was on her feet, and 1,000 extra naval personnel. These ships, the largest ever commissioned by our Navy, will ensure an awakening for our nation of a golden maritime age. It is because of the skill and dedication of the men and women who built that ship that her launch marks not the end of the order book, but the beginning of a new chapter for Portsmouth Shipyard. £1 billion of investment, assisted area status, a maritime task force, the Defence Growth Partnership, and our very own minister, enabling business to transform Portsmouth and the Solent into the maritime heart of the UK. And in mentioning the new office of Minister for Portsmouth, I must pay tribute to the Right Honourable Member for Sevenoaks for the sterling work he is doing to deliver this for my city and the nation. My advice is, if you want a job doing, ask a busy minister. And such is my city's confidence that we have never sought progress at the expense of our sister base ports of Plymouth, home of the amphibious fleet, and of Faslane, home to the deterrent submarines. I pray that a year from now, the Royal Navy will still have all three bases, and those submarines remain damned un-English. I pay tribute to the achievements of the best Navy in the world, and to 350 years' service of the Royal Marines. The Prime Minister recently spoke about the UK being a small island with a big footprint in the world. That could equally apply to Portsmouth, the only island city in the UK. From the top of Portsdown Hill, whose Palmerston's forts point their guns inland, as that was the only way the city was considered vulnerable to attack, you can see the whole of Portsmouth's few square miles, but the city's reach stretches far out of sight. Our goods and services are exported around the globe, our satellites circle the heavens above, and our citizens fuel the imagination. We are the city of Brunel, Dickens, and Conan Doyle, who, when he was not writing prescriptions and detective novels, was keeping goal for Portsmouth FC. That football club is now owned by its fans. Pompey has blazed a trail for other clubs and given supporter involvement in football governance the legitimacy and momentum it deserves. That triumph was a wonderful expression of the Pompey spirit, of determination, resilience, and a close community bond. There are other examples too. We have organised and fundraised to give the Hilsey Lido a new lease of life, a project for which I have gladly sacrificed money, time, and almost all of my dignity. In Wimmering, we have come together with Highbury College to save for community use a Tudor manor in the middle of a housing estate, left to decay by the council, now rescued by residents. Touchingly, the manor's gardening group has christened its hedgehog mascot in honour of the man who enabled community asset transfer to become the norm. His name is Eric Prickles. The Lime Grove Cake Forum, the Beneficial Foundation, the Baffin's Pond Association, the South Sea Greenhouse and many other community groups work hard to improve their communities. We love our city and we love our country too. It has been said that Portsmouth is peopled by those who express their patriotism in their lives, the ultimate expression of which is to serve in our armed forces. I am proud that this government is to review the roles in our services currently barred to women to make sure we make use of best talent. In doing so, there must be no compromise of standards, but we must recognise we cannot set women up to fail. Training must be tailored to enable us to be our best. I have benefited from some excellent training by the Royal Navy, but on one occasion I felt it was not as bespoke as it might have been. Fascinating though it was, I felt that the lecture and practical demonstration on how to care for your penis and testicles in the field failed to appreciate that some of us attending had been issued with the incorrect kit. Women will embrace that challenge. That certainly has been Portsmouth's experience. The all-woman crew who beat all comers in the Portsmouth Regatta of 1824. Herta Ayrton, suffragette and inventor of the Ayrton fan, who spoilt her 1911 census paper thus: "How can I answer all these questions if I have not the intelligence to choose between two candidates for Parliament?" The girls in the wall, like the now 96-year-old Mary Verrier, her experience is the subject of a new play, Tender Loving Care, and those who learn to trade while coping with motherhood or widowhood or both. And today, the first women submariners and the first female commanders of our warships. I look forward to other such firsts for women who serve. The review sends a strong message, not only to them, but to nations where women's rights and talents are accounted too cheaply. I am proud today that we have a parliamentary first, an all-woman double act to propose and second the Loyal Address, and delighted to serve as the warm-up act for the Honourable Member for Mid Dorset and Poole. Member for Gainsborough is concerned about the consequence of the coalition running its full course. He might see us as the Thelma and Louise of the parliamentary session, driving at top speed to the Grand Canyon of electoral defeat. Let me reassure him that this will not be the case, because unlike a 1966 Thunderbird, this coalition is right-hand drive. We must guard against being like those Palmerston forts on Portsdown Hill. Our default position, introspection. We must turn and face the horizon and face those issues of which Tweedsmuir spoke. Before the next Queen's speech, the future of at least one union will be decided, and possibly two. We will have withdrawn our troops from Afghanistan. We will have moved towards greater energy self-sufficiency, grappled with Russian aggression and the Syria crisis, fought the evil that is modern slavery, further paid down the deficit, and continued with our long-term economic plan. If we are to be successful in these endeavours, then we must draw from the same sources as our forebears did as D-Day dawned. We must take confidence from our heritage. We must be willing to serve a cause greater than ourselves. We must show unity of purpose and the dual belief in the right of our cause and our ability to achieve it. And if we ever doubt that our nation's best days lie ahead, that our country can accomplish all it sets out to do, lose sight of our duty and the principles and values that underpin it, then 60 miles, 220 degrees southwest of this chamber lies our inspiration.